I was on top of my desk. I was the first one on top of my desk, and I was like, I'm not coming down. Someone find the goddamn spider. This is bullshit. No, this is honor science. I'm not supposed to do this. Get me down. We never found Rosie.
That sounds illegal for him to have.
It should have been.
Only if you're a narc. The good, the bad, and the science. Television, movies,
comedians, and scientists. The good, the bad, and the science. Welcome to The Good, the Bad, and the Science, the show that breaks down the science of television and movies with a comedian and a scientist. Today, we're discussing Dune, so I'll ask about sandworms, deserts, and dragonfly helicopters. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh, and I've got two fascinating guests joining me today. My first guest is a Los Angeles-based comedian and writer. He's performed at festivals and colleges across the country, including Bumbershoot, Big Pine Comedy Festival, and the University of Connecticut. He's also been featured on Amazon's Coming to the Stage. Welcome to the show, Justin Clark.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Happy that you are here, sir. And talking about Dune today, did you enjoy yourself in the Dune?
It was a solid movie. It's a lot better than I was expecting. I don't know why. You can't put Timothy and Disney character together in a movie and expect me to think it's going to be good. But Zendaya, that girl knows what she's doing.
Yeah. She's doing something right for sure. And we were talking briefly before the pod. We're in a similar situation where we both didn't watch Dune until being required to for this podcast. And we both enjoyed it. I also was like surprised by how much I liked it. I was like, oh, wait a minute. I should have ran and seen this in theaters. What's wrong with me?
This is all a flick. And I've also never seen the original. So I think, because Denis Villeneuve, however you say his last name, he did the Blade Runner remake, which was like, yes, a good movie in its own right. But the fact that Blade Runner is Blade Runner, I was like, well, this isn't the original Blade Runner, so I don't like it as much. But not seeing the original Dune was probably a better idea.
Yeah, well, possibly, but I don't know, and that's why we have another guest on the program who I assume is chomping at the bit here, salivating to nerd out about Blade Runner and Dune. He is a writer and science communicator for Seeker, and if you're a gamer, you know him from his work on NVIDIA GeForce, but to me, he's a brilliant guy who's always down to goof around. It's Julian Huguet.
Hey, Ethan, how you doing, bud?
I'm great. How are you, Julian?
I'm excited to be back. I also didn't watch Dune when it came out for a long time, but I thought it was like a really weird sequel to Spice World. Like, you know, the 1990s Spice Girls movie? And I was like, they went in a weird direction with this other one, and I just didn't get around to it. And then turns out it's totally unrelated.
That's the sequel we need, actually. That would do really well, I think.
it would spice up my life.
That's for sure. So, Julian, are you deeper into this Dune than we are? Like, have you read the book? Do you know all these aspects of it that maybe Justin and I would have missed?
I'm a sci-fi nerd, but I will confess that actually reading the 1965 novel is something I haven't done yet. And it seemed like this is just like uber nerd territory. Like the people I talk to who have read Dune are so obsessed with it. It was almost kind of intimidating. Mm. And then I watched the movie and I was like, I'm in it now. I want to know all about these like rival families and this galactic empire. And I'll just feed it into my brain. So I'm looking forward to picking it up now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, to me, it does seem like now the kind of the godfather of sci-fi movies. Like, it seems like Star Wars pulled a bunch of stuff from Dune, and yet we've had, like, I think we're at 9,400 Star Wars movies.
Yeah, I almost feel for, like, Dune OG nerds who are going to watch this and, like, hear criticisms from people who don't know better, who are like, oh, man, all these plot lines are lifted from Star Wars. And it's like, no, it's other way around, probably.
Yeah, definitely. So you saw it then for the first time recently or for this pod?
Yeah, specifically for this pod when you guys were like, you want to talk about Dune? I was like, I guess, but I don't know what, you know, Scary Spice and Baby Spice, the science behind them, really. So I'll do what I can.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. It seems like the both of you did as well, correct? I mean, we're all on the same page here. We approve of Dune.
Yeah, so good. Can't wait for part two.
When is it supposed to come out? Do we know?
Oh, I don't know. I'll do some quick research here. I mean, my assistant.
2023, it says. I don't know when in 2023, but we probably just have to wait about a year. But yeah, I really thought it was awesome. I feel bad. I feel like it would have been really awesome in the theater. So, you know, if you guys get a chance to do that, or I guess for the second one, let's all line up and see it together. That'll be really fun.
Ooh, that'd be fun.
So before we jump into like super science land, I wanted to see, Justin, if you had any questions. I have a couple just about like Dune character or plot stuff.
Okay. So Timothy Chalamet's character is a lordling, essentially. His dad, his family. So his dad is essentially a lord in the military of one of the big guys. He's occupying, I assume, one of the planets or territories, gets called to Dune land. Essentially, and his mom's a space witch who has ulterior almost motives, but is also mom and is also, yep. So that part was, but also King bad guy that we don't really see, who's just directing Skarsgård's character around. I guess my question is, he's threatened by...
This is the guy pitching the movie to this.
Yeah, this is how I sold this. He's threatened by Timothy Chalamet's powers? Is that what all this was kind of about?
No, I think the Poe Dameron's family, because now I can't remember Oscar Isaac's name either, but they're growing in power and popularity, and the Emperor is generally threatened. So giving them control of Arrakis, the spice world, is inevitably going to lead to a war with the Harkonnen family. And they'll therefore both houses will be weakened and the Emperor's position will be secured. Yeah, that I think that's the overarching like family drama behind the scenes.
It was a preemptive power play, essentially.
Exactly.
My other question is, the spice is essentially some kind of mineral that will direct you through, that helps people travel through space or like avoids. That was the spice. What the spice does was they mentioned it was something to do with space travel.
Yeah, it seems like it serves multiple purposes, right?
Yeah, the movie's pretty vague specifically about what it does, but apparently it gives whoever, you know, uses the spice these kind of like psychic visions of the future. And the reason that's essential for space travel in the books and in the movie is because like it enables faster than light travel, because it gives these navigators the ability to plot where they're going to end up when they come out of a wormhole, basically. Because otherwise the possibilities are too complex and they won't be able to accurately know where they're going to go.
Oh, that's actually kind of fascinating. Okay.
That's cool. Right? Isn't it cool?
That's actually pretty cool.
This just in Dune, actually pretty cool.
Turns out. All right.
Put that on the box.
Great podcast. See you guys next time.
You should have done that at the, that on the trailer.
Pretty cool. I'd say.
Pretty cool.
Actually pretty cool. And Oscar Isaac's character is named Leto, I believe.
Oh, that's right.
Or Leto.
Which I can't believe they didn't get Jared Leto for it, just because it feels a missed opportunity.
Thank God.
Would have been easier on all of us.
We would have just called it Oscar Isaac. A Blade Runner sequel.
Oscar Isaac from South Florida, just like me, and was in a ska band. So the year is 10,191 in this film. And in some ways that totally made sense to me, as far as like, you know, traveling from planet to planet. I was like, okay, checks out, 10,191. And then in other ways, we had like kind of some basic or, you know, mechanical stuff, like the helicopter, for example, which was extraordinarily strange.
Are we talking about the dragonfly stuff?
Ornithopter, I believe it's called, which is like a dragonfly helicopter. If you haven't seen it, it does have blades like a helicopter. They don't spin. They kind of vibrate up and down like wings. And they are like not impervious to sand. And the planet's made of sand. It's a desert planet. And so I did think it was weird that they were like, machines don't do well in the sand. And I was like, yeah, but year 10,000. Mm-hmm. You don't have that?
It's also ironed out yet? It's also a planet your entire existence is kind of dependent on, with despite needing the spice. You would think you would start building things around around that planet.
Yeah, I don't know. Some sort of magnetized thing that sucks out the sand. I don't know. I'm not that advanced.
They have force fields, right? You can't like have a bubble around the ornithopter or whatever. No.
Right.
No. Sand still gums up the works. Still a good reason for Anakin to hate it. We haven't solved the issue of sand yet, 8,000 years in the future.
This book was written in the 50s. The book was written in the 50s? Do we know when this book was written?
Came out in 1965.
65. So this was before the war. This was before, like, the Afghan-Russian Civil War and everything. So this isn't, like, an analogy of, like, oil.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the streaming wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
It is a commentary on planetary, like, environmental changes and destruction, because apparently the author was living in Oregon, and in Oregon there are these shifting dunes that, you know, they've always been moving around, right? And they, once people build, you know, cities and towns and stuff, though, as the dunes move around, they threaten these towns. So the people who live there were trying to figure out, since like the 1800s, people in Oregon have like trying to basically get these dunes to settle down. And the plan they came up with was like planting this European like beach grass, basically. And so he was living in Oregon when these projects to plant this grass and lock the dunes in place was underway. And he just thought it was really interesting that like humans or any sort of species would try and engineer their environment that way. And it was also at the time when the space race was just heating up, and we had basically sent the first probe to Venus in 62, Mariner 2, and the images it sent back from Venus totally changed what we actually thought about the planet. We used to think it was like kind of a like a paradise, like forest Earth, like an Endor kind of thing. And when Mariner 2 went by it and took images of it, it was like, oh my God, this place is a nightmare. Like, it's crazy hot. The atmosphere is toxic. Like, what is with these scary, dangerous other planets? And so he kind of took those ideas and put them together into Dune.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's it's probably so just wild to think about seeing planets for the first time, like up close, what they're actually like, and probably so scary of like, oh no, we don't have a chance anywhere else. We're still kind of figuring that out today. It really upsets me that they're still trying to convince us that we're going to move to Mars and all is going to be chill.
The things they talk about on other planets, like Jupiter's got a tornado or something that's the size of Earth that just goes around the planet constantly. That's fair. Jesus Christ.
Just bed there centuries. Yeah. Rains diamonds on Neptune, I think.
I also saw it as like, yeah, a parallel of just like how countries treat each other as far as these planets, you know, nations going from planet to planet kind of taking over. But I want it. I have to circle back, fly back to this copter. I'm very curious, Julian, what your thoughts are on the plausibility, the physics. Does that check out to you? Could we one day have these copters?
So what's really interesting about the movie's depiction of the ornithopters is it really goes in a unique direction that I don't think a lot of people who read the books might have considered, because the books just describes the ornithopters of having flapping wings, right? And, you know, I think most people would go with like the route of a bird or something like that. But these dragonfly-esque ornithopters are so cool, and then it makes you think about like how do insects fly, because the way insects generate lift is totally different from how we at a larger scale fly with either aircraft or, you know, like jets or helicopters or things like that. And famously, there's a quote a total misunderstanding of research that's like, basically, when scientists were looking into it and they declared that, like, bees don't fly the same way that planes do, somehow that got garbled in translation, and the media's message was like, scientists declare that bees can't fly, which obviously is not the case. Like, we know they can fly.
So on illusion,
but
Michael.
But the way they generate... they're not even real. Bees are real. But the way that they generate lift... is because the way their flexible wings beat, basically, is they, you know, flap forward and rotate as they flap, and then the same way going backwards. And this generates vortexes at the leading edge of the wing that basically generates lift and brings the insect up. But you need these, like, special wing structures and this really complex movement that, like, would be super difficult for us to engineer mechanically at a larger scale. So it's really cool that, like, these future things can do it, because then it enables special ways that insects fly. Like, you know, dragonflies can fly backwards, you know, same way a helicopter can. But, like, they can do all these really nimble movements. Hummingbirds also, they're the only bird that can fly backwards. And they, bird wings, though, in general, right, work in a similar way by, like, generating these vortex, but not exactly the same as an insect's wing. So it's cool that the movie had this vision of these ornithopters like dragonflies. But from an engineering standpoint, it would be needlessly complex when you could get, like, basically a rotating wing, which is a helicopter's rotor, and just get a lot of the same benefits.
The amount of WD-40 you would need just in that ball bearing joint, that's all I could think about. I was just like,
it would be the second most valuable resource.
We're in a desert. Yeah, absolutely. The amount of oil you need just to keep that thing going, not even... with gas. I was just like, just to keep those moving parts lubricated. I was like, this is insane. And there's sand getting in there. I'm out of this premise. You've lost me.
I call BS.
I kind of just geek out over futuristic vehicles, period. So anytime there was a new vehicle in the movie, I was like, yep, let's see more of this. How does this work? Love it. And the helicopter, or the ornithopter, I should say, captured my attention for sure. And at the same time, I was like, but also, why so primitive? Why can't we? It's not that different than a helicopter, which seems like we're 8,000 years later. I don't know why we would still be doing this. But I did love it. And I thought it was really cool. And I loved how the wings could also go back and you could easily go into, like, dive mode, like suicide mode.
The dive mode was cool. I would say, like, I was like, yeah, this is all right.
There have been, you know, like, fighter jets and some military bombers and stuff that have, like, wings that can increase the sweep angle the faster that you travel. F-14s. Yes, exactly. F-14s, B-1 bombers. There's a lot of Russian, like, Soviet era jets that can do it too. But you don't see them now because when you sweep the wing back, it's, like, a good way of reducing the airplane's drag. But it also changes, like, you know, the center of lift on the plane. And it's a total pain in the ass to make, like, that kind of airframe work. So now we're just really good at designing wings and, you know, flight control systems that you can have a solid wing. It's just easier that way. But looks cool in sci-fi.
Yeah, that's for sure. So what about, I mean, we have to talk about the sandworm, obviously. It might have been my favorite part of the movie. I don't even know how to describe this thing. It's just absolutely humongous. First of all, I don't know. They didn't really relate it to anything else. I don't know if they said. Did they say, do you know?
They, in the little, like, exposition, you know, holograph bit, they describe them as being up to 400 meters long. So 4 football fields, basically.
Yeah, that seems about right. If anything, it seems bigger just in the way that it's moving across the desert. But I did want to get your thoughts on how it related to any sort of animal that we have today, as far as being attracted to rhythmic noises or the way that its teeth worked. I thought that was really fascinating, how it had these, like, long strands of teeth, basically.
Yeah, well, you know, when you start imagining like extraterrestrial biology, right, there's so many interesting ways, like, shapes they can take. But a worm is a solid bet. You know, we're very familiar with worms. I was reading, actually, to be ready to talk here on this podcast, a guy who's, like, a nematode expert talking about why he loves the worms in Dune. And nematodes, he drew a lot of parallels because, like, they can have all these different mouth kind of configurations depending on their environment. And depending on their environment, the same worm species can develop like different mouths. Like if it's in a place where like there's a lot of other nematodes it could eat, it might have like a tooth for like to attack. But if it's in another place that like it might be eating smaller like things or like sifting through the soil, it can have more of like a kind of filtered mouth, I think the guy was saying.
Whoa.
So that's pretty cool. The sandworms though are so massive, right? Like 400 meters in length. For comparison's sake, a blue whale, the largest animal on Earth today, is like 30 meters in length.
We're talking
like at least 10 times bigger for a sandworm here, which is nuts. But then at those scales, like you start to hit issues like just the sandworm crushing itself, you know, under its own weight. Like the reason sea animals can get so large is because the water supports the weight of their body. And then when they get beached, unfortunately, they die because they crush themselves to death. They're just too heavy for their frames to support. So you can imagine a 400 meter long sandworm having this issue, especially because worms are also like invertebrates. You know, they don't have backbones and skeletons to support that their body. So if you just scale them up, you get like, it wouldn't work. That's why you don't see giant insects today. You know, that their exoskeletal structures just can't support them. But they're a really important part of the Dune universe, but this is starting to get into like spoiler territory for what's going to be part two of the movie. So I don't think we should
spoil
talk about
me, boy.
It. But they are an important part of their environment. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you compared it to the whale in water, because I also thought about that when the sand, they were in the sand, Josh Brolin's character and Paul, and their hands were in it, and the worm was coming, and the vibration kind of made the sand act like water. And so then I was, you know, and then I was like, oh, okay, now I'm kind of seeing how this worm easily, you know, makes its way through the desert.
Oh, and if you want to talk about, you know, animals that hunt based on rhythmic vibrations and stuff, I mean, that's completely a thing. Like, spiders know something's in their web because of, like, a telltale vibration, right? Like, that an insect that's trapped has. Because a lot of spiders, you know, they have 8 eyes, but they don't necessarily have fantastic vision. But an interesting issue that arises then is you get some spider predators, like other spiders. There's a jumping spider called the Portia spider that hunts different spiders and other jumping spiders. And if it can't jump to it or like trap it in some way, what they'll do is they'll walk up to the edge of the web, because jumping spiders have great eyesight, and they'll put their legs in the web and they'll pluck at the strings in the pattern of a struggling insect, and they'll draw the spider that made the web over, and then they'll pounce.
Spiders are fucked up.
Damn.
Man.
They're so cool. I actually just got a pet jumping spider this week.
Oh my lord.
Okay. They're so cool.
We have different pets. My 7th and 8th grade science teacher had a rose-haired tarantula, not defanged, as like the class thing. And we walked into class one day and some chick goes, "Mr. Winston, where's Rosie?" And we looked. I was on top of my desk. I was the first one on top of my desk. And I was like, I'm not coming down. Someone find the goddamn spider. This is bullshit. No, this is honor science. I'm not supposed to do this. Get me down. We never found Rosie.
That sounds illegal for him to have.
It should have been. He was. I will say, Mr. Winston, right? Mr. Winston was solid.
Only if you're a narc.
Later that year, six months later, we're like in the hallway doing like group projects or something like that. And we were like down by one of the doors, and someone just like is like, "There's a tarantula outside, like at the door." Seattle. We don't have tarantulas just walking around Seattle. And so like Mr. Winston like ran out with his spider glove, like a, and it wasn't Rosie. It was just some other tarantula.
A different one?
Yeah. That some kid down the street had lost. I was like, what are the odds? Get me out of here.
Yeah, that's when you transfer schools. I have a few more. I got to get to this stuff because I was like so, I was enraptured by this. First of all, I'm all about trying to heal my body. I'm in my 30s, guys. I'm not going to lie to you. And when I get an injury nowadays, it just hangs out with me. It doesn't go anywhere.
It's forever now.
Yeah, it's a forever injury now. So in the movie, this guy, the evil character, oh man, what is his name? I have his name here somewhere. Vladimir is healing in this like tub of oil.
Yeah.
And I've seen stuff like that in Star Wars too, not calling anybody out. But what I think that's just a common thing. And so, you know, I feel like the closest thing that we have right now is like an ice bath. And I was curious, Julian, if this, you know, if there's some sort of like comparison that's like high tech or like for the fancy people that I don't know about that does heal us, or if there's something on the horizon that we're working on that might heal us in the future.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The break is over. Here we go back to the show about science.
Okay, so I didn't actually prepare for this interview with any research on like that regenerative goo stuff. I thought we were going to talk about maybe wormholes, so I did a lot of reading on how those might work according to like general relativity, but I'll take a crack at this. Off the top of my head, the only thing I can really consider that exists today is probably the use of like stem cell therapies, like regenerative therapies. And the idea is you take some cells that haven't figured out what they want to be yet when they grow up. So they can specialize, they can differentiate into many different types of cells, right? Like it can become a heart cell or a liver cell or skin or whatever. And you can use these to repair damaged tissue. You know, we're using them for like treating burns or like heart disease. My dad actually had a surgery. His knee, he had some stem cells injected into it, and it apparently actually helped his knee heal. So the thing about stem cells is there's a few different types. You can have either pluripotent or multipotent. So pluripotent are the most versatile. They can become way more different specialized cells. And then multipotent can only become a few different types of cells. And pluripotent cells, one place that you can find them is with embryos, like human embryos. So these are, you know, developing embryos, and they're only, you can only get them like when they're 3 to 5 days old. So pretty early in the human development process. And even then, the blastocyst, as it's called, only has about 150 pluripotent stem cells to make use of. So this is obviously a controversial subject. So there's been research in how to make other cells, possibly from adults, into pluripotent as opposed to multipotent cells, and so you can get a lot of those same benefits. Last thing I remember in 2014, there was a big breakthrough in turning adult stem cells into pluripotent cells that could then be used. I think it's still something they're testing because there's issues about possibly like the durability of these cells or like if they were maybe damaged from like, you know, toxins in the environment that the adults that they were harvested from may have been exposed to, that sort of thing. There's also a field where they are taking cells that are developing, like stem cells, and pulling out the nucleus of that cell and then putting in the nucleus from a cell from the intended recipient, so they can still develop as, you know, pluripotent stem cells. And then when you actually use them in regenerative therapy, the patient's body is less likely to reject them. But that's an ongoing field of research. So yeah, if I had to guess, it's probably some sort of bath, like, you know, regenerative cells that will fix whatever tissue was damaged by that, you know, poisonous gas that the Baron might have inhaled.
Okay, so the other one I wanted to actually mention was the There were two parts. There was one that was a light that follows you. There was like a floating light that I thought was awesome and so convenient and cool. And then the other one was the checking the vitals by hand. Is that just, you think, like super magic stuff? Or is there actually a way to like tell how somebody's doing by, you know, pressing on certain pressure points or something?
The whole vital sign, you know, aside from like the pulse and things that you can just determine obviously by touch, right? Like the just touching somebody and being like, oh, you've got your cholesterol's a little high, let's work on that. That's pure sci-fi, you know. I mean, there's like scanning technologies and stuff that maybe in the future could be miniaturized or something. But it looks like the explanation in Dune is very much like there's some psychic goings on that we'll just kind of use to fill in some whatever the plot may call for.
The shield was interesting as well.
Again, that's if the military could develop, you know, like personal sci-fi shields. Oh, man, they'd be just dumping money into it. Which is funny because in the movie, you know, I assume that's why we've necessitated sword fights again, because like the shields only let slow moving objects go through. So like if you tried to shoot somebody, I guess it would just flat out reject the bullet. Just no.
But like a dart got in there. That was like the things that could get in. I was like, all right, this is blocking swords and shit. But this guy just hits you in the back with a dart and it got in.
Or yeah,
the things what that could get
is the dart. If the dart's going slow enough, right? Okay. Like the dart gets there, and then it slows it like down or like to penetrate this shield. Yeah,
and I have no idea. Like so they never really explained what the shield, how it stops things, because it looked like every time it would like vibrate, it would just go. Zzz. It's like, all right, what is this a fly trap? Nah. What is happening?
That's another just a sci-fi kind of imagination thing. Years and years ago, I was doing I was writing some YouTube episode about like, okay, if we were to make some sort of personal shield out of like, let's say a magnetic field or something, like what would that look like? And it turns out to deflect like a bullet, it would need to be an insanely powerful personal magnetic field to the point, I think it would cause like health issues for you internally. Like you wouldn't want to be near it. And then on top of that, like what if the projectile coming at you isn't magnetic, you know, if it's like ceramic or something like that in nature, then your fancy super powerful it's just who cares, right? So I think this idea of just anything that stops a any sort of projectile, you know, and it doesn't matter like the makeup of it, that's sci-fi, because you've got to ask like, okay, like what exactly is the principle this field is operating on? If it's magnetic, then the thing that's penetrating the shield or that it's stopping has to react to magnetic fields. And if it doesn't, like, it's useless, you know, that sort of thing. So to just stop any sort of matter like that, it's just kind of the catch-all sci-fi, like, ooh, force field, okay, cool, we've stopped it. Neat. Yeah.
All right, I got two quick ones for you. I know we're running low on time. You can try to answer them both. You can pick one. This is up to
Let's
you,
do it.
Julian. This is a nice, fun
Lightning
game
round.
For you. Yeah, exactly. So number one, I wanted to ask about the earpiece that's not in their ear, the earpiece that's behind their ear. I was curious about that because to me it sounds like if I can talk or listen to anything and not have it actually in my ear, that sounds great. And then two, the steel suit, recycling our own sweat and then immediately drinking it. How can I do that? That sounds cool.
Okay, I'm going to try and actually tackle both of these. So let's start with that little in-ear, behind-the-ear radio, right? The thing that comes to mind for me, if I had to guess, would be something akin to like the cochlear implants that we actually have today. These are useful for people who are hard of hearing. And what they are basically is it's just like a strand of electrodes that's inserted into a person's cochlea. That's the spiral structure inside their ear. And these electrodes can stimulate, you know, certain nerves associated with frequencies that you hear. You know, if you were stimulated by sound waves hitting your ear, it would vibrate your eardrum and eventually, you know, your cochlea, these specific nerves at different frequencies would fire off. And so we can right now sort of replicate that to a degree with these implants. So I imagine, you know, in the future, these might be much more fine-tuned to actually transmit like really high definition, you know, high clarity audio. And then you could couple that with just like a transmitter and receiver and basically have a super fancy involved walkie-talkie implant. And the steel suit is also something that's not that far-fetched at all because, you know, astronauts aboard the ISS, obviously it's important that they retain as much water as possible, or, you know, like sailors on submarines, right? Like you've got a limited supply of this water and like how do you maximize what you have? And so the ISS famously has plenty of filtration systems that collect astronaut urine, stuff like that. clean it, and then it gets just reintroduced right into the drinking supply. So they kind of make a joke of it in Dune, right? Like, you're like basically drinking your piss. But it's like, you know, if you want to basically do space travel, like that's going to be a reality you deal with already. So it's just like wicking it off of your body and processing it and then feeding it back into your mouth.
Like, how did it get? That's what I was like. I kind of want to know, and I don't want to know. I was like, is there an urethra tube in this suit that just goes, that just fits right in? I was like, how is it getting back in there?
Yeah.
Because I don't see anything. I don't see a tube.
Yeah, that's why the judge was so impressed when she was like, oh, have you worn one of these before? And, you know, Timothy Chalamet's like, no, I just already know how to use a catheter. Like,
Okay, well, I, as always, thank you, Julian, for helping us out. Thank you for guiding us through this epic desert story. And thank you, Justin, for joining us for the first time. And Justin, if there's anything you want to tell people about, now is the time. Let us know.
No, this was great. Thanks for listening. The one question I had was, how does their eyes turn blue? Do we have anything like spice that lets our eyes change colors?
The makeup artists on Dune, they had these like colored contact lenses that you can just put in and then
easy. It. There's no that,
and they're made of spice.
Yep, and they're made.
And Julian, anything you want to tell people about?
Once again, you know, this, the Good, Bad, and the Science podcast is part of the, you know, Seekers Podcast Network, and we have a Seeker Plus podcast as well, that I'm hosting. We actually just did an episode on Venus and how, like, sci-fi concepts of it change so much and why the planet is such a nightmare, and it would be, like, so, so difficult to try and terraform and make it a livable place. So, if you're curious about, like, ecosystems on other planets and how our understanding of them has changed, check out Seeker Plus, because that episode should be coming out soon.
Hell yeah. Okay, awesome. And Justin, you want people to follow you on Facebook?
Yeah, but Facebook, let's do it. I've been on there since 2006, back when it was the old elitist Facebook, where you needed a four-year college email. Twitter, Instagram, it's all the same. It's Justin H. Clark, very ethnic name. But yeah, follow for just vibrant and positive tweets.
Awesome.
But yeah, thanks for having me. This was a blast. And every sci-fi movie should come with a scientist at the end, where it's just like,
yeah,
you have 10 questions every time.
No, that's why we do it. That's our mission here, is to ruin the movie and maybe educate some people a little bit, but mostly myself.
Just two idiots and a scientist.
My ankle. Yeah, exactly. All right, well, I thank you both. Thank you guys for listening as well, and we will see you next time.
Bye. Hey, thanks for having me, guys.